Data actually is the mother's milk of AI. So you can't get to AI without data. And if you think about all these things in a smart city as surveillance mechanisms, and don't just think of the word surveillance as spooky, think about surveillance in a way as just watching what we do, which then helps us to create better ways of doing things in the future. Then the people who hold the data and the mass amounts of data are king. They have the key to the castle. So when we talk about data taxes and we talk about a data trust, it's almost, again, a future state library that nation states should think about having, where if you are an organization that collects enormous amounts of data, you should be compelled to at least share some portion of potentially that de-identified data with a public repository that is accessible to all.
Hi, Smart Community friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Smart Community Podcast. In this episode, I have a brilliant conversation with Natasha Bleicher, the founder of the boutique digital law firm Sterling & Rose. Natasha advises on Web 3.0, crypto assets, data, privacy, digital asset infrastructure, and smart legal contracts, and also helped author the 2022 Oxford Smart Legal Contract textbook. In this episode, Natasha tells us about her background in emerging tech law and her passion for the digital free movement. And we discuss the need to balance frictionless tech solutions while still keeping humans involved and able to intervene in smart communities. Natasha and I explore the rise of artificial intelligence and the possibilities of smart legal contracts, as well as discussing the potential terms and conditions of smart cities. Natasha tells us why she has a digital-free room in her house and the human need to disconnect. And we talk about the benefits and risks of digital-free national parks and other public spaces. We finish our chat discussing the emerging idea of our implantable future and the need for regulated digital quiet times within it, as well as where to next for making data and artificial intelligence more equitable. You might have noticed in the last few episodes, we have left the where to next for smart cities and communities question in the main interview. We are making a little shift in our programming going forwards and won't be doing the where to next mashup episodes anymore, but we'll keep this content within the main interview. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Natasha. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you, Zoe. Pleased to be with you.
I am very excited to have you on the podcast. Very excited to have this conversation. So let's just jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you're passionate about?
I surely can. I am a lawyer and I run an emerging tech law firm. So I have been a technology lawyer for many, many years. And so you might say that smart cities are right up my alley because I work with large corporations, governments, and startups, some of them big startups and some of them small startups, in the development and the performance of technologies that help create and run smart cities. You would say that's the primary things I work on, and other areas of interest which point towards smart cities and perhaps we might say point away from smart cities is I'm also very, very interested in smart legal contracts as some of the rules that assist in the software and the development of the actual hardware that goes into smart cities and how people are impacted by the technology, particularly in response of, say, surveillance, privacy, confidentiality, surveillance of bodies, faces, all those good things. And last but not least, the thing that may point away from smart cities is I'm very interested in a new call that's in respect of what's called digital free national parks or the digital free movement. And the digital free movement is actually about curating spaces around us, whether they be in the wild, like digital free national parks, or in cities like libraries, having places which where there is no ability to have connection. And I can get into that later, but that is sort of the anti-smart city. That is the dumb or analog part of the city, which is part of the yin and yang, part of the balance.
Yeah, I'm really keen to talk about that because a lot of the things we talk about on the podcast is, well, you know, I talk to many different people, but my kind of philosophy is that we don't necessarily need technology all the time to be smart. And actually, can we create spaces in our lives where we reduce that? Because, you know, to buy back our leisure time, basically, and to really connect on that human level. So I think it still is part of what I call smart community, because we want to be able to enable those places that people really want. And again, if that's what the community is asking for, that's what we want to kind of provide and service. And also thinking about the ability to have those spaces is kind of enabled by the technology in itself, if that makes sense. Like, you know, to be analog is because we can have a privilege of having technology and connection and doing all these things. If we can have then ability to say no to that, so then we can actually have time without it, I think is also a really interesting kind of thought behind having places that are digital free.
100%. If you're really talking about the word smart, we would be pretty dumb as a community if we didn't have places that you could disconnect. There is so much evidence that suggests that, particularly for that generation, which has been born under the iPhone generation, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that we have compromised our mental health, our physical health, with greater levels of connectivity. And yeah, being smart doesn't just involve process improvement and ubiquity of digital connection. It actually involves disconnection. Yeah, could bang on about that for hours.
Oh, I like it. We're going to bang on about that for maybe not hours, but maybe we can at another time, a long-form podcast per se. But we'll go broad and then we'll dive into that in a bit more detail. But what is a smart community to you?
A smart community is a frictionless community. So, you know, I'm somebody who has lots of children. So being in a community or walking around a space that's quite difficult if you have to get out 6 different credit cards when you want to go through public transport, or you need to use a different app every single time you do something, those are frictions. And if you want to pay, but it's a shuffle through your handbag, that's also difficult. So a smart city that is efficient and frictionless through best case use of technologies is brilliant. And I'll give you an exact example of that. Simple things like being able to just use your phone to get onto a train rather than having a dedicated token, service, payment methodology. That's just one little friction that makes your fluidity of movement better. And it is difficult to, as I said, work out that balance from when you go from a smart community to a 1984 community. And I think it was really interesting. I've just got back from Singapore and I love taking photographs of nature. I'm obsessive nature photography. And of course, there are so many choice options about what you're going to take photos of in Singapore. But I found myself with these beautiful, almost mirroring images between beautiful flowers and also enormous number of surveillance cameras on the streets of Singapore. They almost look like flowers. They've got 7 budding lenses that point in every direction. So I love the frictionless of, you know, if a crime's being committed, of being able to establish who did that and have excellent processes that feed that to the court system. But then, of course, I like the balance of human in the loop, where we can get back to a person at some point when, for example, your card doesn't work at the train, still having a person there who can intervene.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a really important balance. And I think it's not one or the other. I think that's what a lot of people think. Oh, well, if it's a smart city, that's why I just stopped using the term smart city, or moving away from it to smart community. But you can have both, but you actually need to be involved and get different people involved to bring these different thoughts in and different experiences in and different talent in, that type of thing. I had a similar experience in Korea, in South Korea, when, you know, I felt really safe to be able to walk around at night, whatever, because I knew that, you know, there were cameras around, there was other things around, also like the social norms and all those type of things as well. But again, that was just my experience as a young woman traveling by myself, knowing that I would live there for 3 months and then leave again and that type of thing. So I think there's so many different elements that come into it. But yeah, I think that's a really nice way to phrase it, where we have this kind of frictionless city. So then we have more, you know, without the friction that isn't, I don't know, useful, or if we can remove friction, then we can spend that time doing more fun, creative, nicer human things rather than, you know, rummaging through our handbags or, you know, spending a lot of time on services when it really should just be quite seamless and quick and easy so we can get to the stuff.
It's really interesting though, isn't it? Because that has always been the moniker of the transition to higher levels of technology, that it will get easier and seamless. And I do actually think that's correct. I like paying with my face, even though it actually, on another existential level, completely freaks me out that I'm paying with my face. But at the same time, there is, you know, when you do have an instinctive reaction, for example, when shopping centres move Amazon style to no cashiers. So, you know, your basket's just being scanned, what you've purchased, and then you remove humans completely. That has an unnerving quality to it. And I think that unnerving quality is our own redundancy, which is very, very topical at the moment, obviously, with what's happening in artificial intelligence. And we do a lot of work at Sterling and Rose on what large institutions' responses should be to the onset of AI, and obviously that AI becoming ubiquitous in its ability to basically replace so many people in so much of what they do. So I don't think that's going anywhere. I think the horse is bolted on that one, but it does mean, when do our smart cities serve us and when do we start serving our smart cities?
Yeah, it's interesting. I read an article a long time ago, well, as long as you can read a smart city article a long time ago, it was probably a couple of years ago, around thinking about it as not what can the city know about me, but what do I need to know about the city to make better decisions or to have a more seamless experience. And I think that's a great concept, and I think aiming towards that. But I agree, I think there's this that impending kind of redundancy of human elements, but what are the things we want to move towards when we do move away from some of these more traditional roles?
So I think about it in my own family, and I have in my own house a digital free room. So I've had that for some time, and it's a demarcated area in my lounge room, which has, it sounds quite off, but it's actually a really pretty room, which has a piece of green tape, subtle green tape across the floor. And everyone in the family knows, and it's quite respected and really quite loved part of the house, that if you step over that tape, you do not bring even a smartphone, you don't bring a watch in, anything that's digital. And we needed it because we're so dependent on our technology that it felt like there needed to be a place which enforced discipline to not be on tech. So it occurs to me that if I need that in my own home, and we are an educated family which knows the perils of dopamine that is associated with continuous connection, then there are many homes and many families and the community at large which is basically supping on continuous dopamine slot machine level of connectivity, which, as I said, it's frictionless, it's amazing, but that also means that a lot of the community often has its head down. When you're walking around a community that's really connected with free Wi-Fi everywhere, people's necks are bent. I don't think that's forever. We'll get to Neuralink soon enough, but people's necks are bent. They're not looking at each other and they're not talking to each other.
Yeah, well, let's go into that a bit more detail. And happy for you to dive more into that concept or talk about some of the other projects and things you've been working on or different things you're involved in. So, yeah, over to you.
So the thing that I'm really interested in and have, I suppose, dedicated my life to is, what does the law need to do at the edge? What does the law need to do as it pushes out its tendrils to new areas that haven't actually been legislated or regulated for? So in this case, we have been heavily involved in work on smart legal contracts. So you would know in your lifetime, I don't know how old you are, Zoe, but we really used to have paper contracts. They were analog, they were tangible, they were the same as money. It was something you could hold in your hand. They have been dematerialized and turned into digital contracts insofar as most people never read the contracts that they enter. They bind them and they tick a box saying, I agree to these terms and conditions. But all the things you do everywhere you go, you're constantly agreeing to contracts that you can't see. And you know, there's this beautiful line in Shoshana Zuboff's book, Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which is a true tome, a true life work, where she says, on some of Google's terms, you could be reading for 300 days to actually read the terms and conditions that you enter into because of all the additional contracts that are brought into the main contract through links. That would never have happened when it was an analog contract. So where we work at the next iteration is programmable contracts. So those are contracts that can do things where they perform themselves, or they send you notices, or they perform their calculations inside of them. They basically give arms and legs to contracts for performance. So where that intersects with smart cities is, again, so much of smart cities is a tech, almost a social contract. When you walk through a city, when you enter a location, do you even have an understanding of the terms and conditions of the places and locations that you enter into? Are they fair? Would you, if you read them, agree to them? And most people don't actually feel like they have any ability to negotiate the contracts that they enter into. So in a perfect world, what smart legal contracts will do is they will, because they're also remembered in a different way, they will give people the ability to curate perhaps a little more in a less sort of David Goliath fashion, the contracts that they enter into. And I'll try to bring some color into that to make it a bit more easy to understand. At the moment, for example, when you surf the internet, you may push cookie parameters. You might say, I agree to these cookies. If you're like me, oftentimes you just couldn't be bothered saying, no, I don't accept, because it pushes you down a decision tree that takes a lot of time. And that's pretty frictionful. So you just say yes, because it's too hard to say no. What has been proposed by Tim Berners-Lee and others who invented the World Wide Web is to say, shouldn't you move around the internet with your own rules about cookies basically attached to your digital persona? So you've already set the rules. And what smart legal contracts can do, and smart contracts, is they can then, for example, if the world is surveilling you, they can allow you to basically claim monies back for that surveillance. And I mean that in the broadest terms. But if, for example, we know with the large language models like GPT-4, Palm from Google, what they've done is they've effectively scraped our digital universe. They've scraped all the things we've produced, but very few people, well, nobody really has been recompensed for those scrapings. So what smart legal contracts do is they kind of, through being an auditable memory trail of performance of a contract, they allow us perhaps to automate a back and forward payment for that surveillance, and indeed for the rights and obligations and remedies that we usually don't do anything about as consumers.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I remember talking about that concept a little while ago, but it was like how to bring that to reality and how that actually works. I guess for that to work, you've got to kind of turn the lens or the focus or the approach right to the customer or the user, which is a very different approach to what we currently have. I mean, even if you think about from a services perspective, say, you know, if I want to renew my license, or I want to change my last name or something along those lines, the amount of different interactions I have to have with the amount of different government agencies that are all serving their own purpose and they're not actually thinking about me as a customer, I have to interact based on the way that they're set up, which is around their terms, whatever, making it easier for them to interact with me, but actually thinking about it the other way around, which one of the concepts of smart communities around governance and those type of things. So how does it become a practical reality where we can actually have our own kind of agency in this and be transacting at that level?
It's incredibly complex, and what's ahead of us is incredibly complex, because in some ways, what you're describing is for people to be treated fairly in the shoes that they stand in. And actually, the rise of artificial intelligence, increasing computer power in hardware, the better chips that we now have, the silicon chips, the more sophisticated chips, it actually means that things like bespoke medicine, being able to really give individual service based on your proclivities and your circumstances, let's call it bespoke adoption of the law, bespoke adoption of medicine based on where you stand, actually those things will become more possible. That's really exciting. But the counterpoint to that is that actually norms, social norms, the more that I surveil you, obviously they do tend to allow people to be seen as a heat map rather than as an individual. So when I think about a smart city, I'm interested in creating infrastructure for the mean. So I may then, you know, the same thing, it's the Netflixification algorithm that starts serving up the same three movies to everybody. Well, that's probably an oversimplification. But inside the city itself, if I have data on everybody and what everybody does, it may mean that I start moving the city to not benefit the outliers, the people who like to do things a little bit differently. I design my infrastructure for the masses because that is the most efficient thing to do.
A city's doing that now, though, the way that they're set up.
Yes.
Already.
They certainly are. I mean, I know that I have been involved for many years as involved in the creation and development of safe active streets. So safe active streets are normal road infrastructure where you replace basically low build costs, but you just replace the tar with a different color, put some bikes on there, but they're normal roads, but they're people first roads. And even to do that, it took years and years, multiple different types of councils and state government involved. But what was needed was to actually do the heat mapping of where cars went first to see which would be the least disruptive. So any time that a government is looking to make infrastructure changes, because most people's KPIs are adjudicated on their efficiency, that certainly infrastructure follows the mean.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And it's like you'd be able to use data more effectively, more efficiently. We talk a lot about, you know, big data and how, you know, it's a bit of a scary topic and that type of thing. But actually we're using data in everyday lives to make decisions, and whether that's small decisions on an individual level and whatever data we have available, or those really big, you know, decisions from a government or a, you know, legal entity, et cetera, using the data that's available. But yeah, I think it is a really interesting, well, it's a really imperative kind of notion that we have to look at what data we are using, and if we are collecting more data, who's going to be benefited and conversely harmed in, you know, the use of that data and that type of thing as well. And I think that's where, from a legal perspective, we're still catching up on how we can effectively govern that. So yeah, I think it's interesting, and I love talking to lawyers. I nearly became a lawyer myself, actually, when I was doing my engineering.
You should be happy, Zoe, because apparently, according to most of the statistics that are out now, at least 50% of us will be replaced by large language models. So maybe it was a good choice not to be there.
I have heard this before as well, but hey, you know, we need people to then help us make ourselves redundant as well. Now, digital free zones, I'm really keen to talk further about those. Have you seen this implemented, obviously, in your own home? But I guess what are some of the other things that you're seeing happen around the space? And, you know, I guess it's not really from a legal perspective, or is it? Is there going to, do you think there will be from?
I think it needs to be from a legal perspective, because in order to get to, for example, a digital free national park, you will need to have express legislative protections that actually create a digital free national park. But maybe I could take a step back and explain what the digital free movement is about. So it's a new movement. And in many ways, you could say it's a movement that is grounded in the rise of AI. And we know that there are, you know, the, let's call them the grey beards and the grey heads of artificial intelligence are saying some quite concerning things about what is happening with artificial intelligence. You know, we're no longer in the narrow AI band. We've moved into generative AI. And it's no longer something that people, experts, would laugh at to say we're approaching an AGI threshold. So it's in that milieu that we've started to look at digital free. And the thesis really goes like this, is that digital disconnection may not be a human right per se, but at a minimum, it's an important human need. Okay, so that's the foundation one, is that actually we do well when we disconnect. We all know that intuitively. But the thesis is number two, that smart cities, smart locations, we're actually moving to wearable devices. And the next step will be implantable devices. It doesn't matter how, if you're not going to say that's not inevitable, that is inevitable. We will move to implantable devices. And that means we will never be disconnected. Then the third limb of the thesis is that We're moving to increasingly complex augmented and virtual realities. And again, you might be looking around and say, aside from that Pokemon craze, that didn't really happen. But if you follow the money and you play the story forward, you know that if you get, as I said, to a full smart city and people can market to you all the time and you are constantly have a Neuralink type connectivity in your head or in your hand, those things will mean that you don't really know up from down. So we're entering potentially a post-truth reality where you don't get to be alone. Then the fourth limb is that there is untrammeled move to full universal global internet coverage. So there's something still in our reality now where there are places, you go on down a dusty road to the back of Denmark in Australia or some places where you can't actually connect to the internet because the satellite coverage is not there. Actually, increasingly, very few places are left in that category, but there are some places. You know, you used to be able to fly on an aeroplane and you couldn't be contacted for a few hours. But that is not the future. Unless we step in and we legislate, basically, we are deploying thousands of satellites into low Earth orbit and increasingly large numbers of satellites for communication into geostationary Earth orbit as well. So there is changes that need to be made. Most of space law is still happening at a nation state level. It's not something where proprietary companies are able to be mitigated and moderated by countries alone. So it's a complex area of law. But if those things are correct, and I'll put it to you that all of those four things I've just said to you are correct, are we happy with the future state of the world, whether that's in 5 years or 10 years, where there is no place on Earth where you will be able to disconnect from access to, surveillance by, or some kind of augmented reality? Is that an acceptable future to us? And I will put it to you, that's not an acceptable future to me. And what can we do to stop it? We want connected smart cities. We want that. So great, let's do that for most of the places. But is it not wise? Is it not prudent? And is it not a good mitigation strategy to say some places should be basically have satellites either turned off in certain spatial coordinates or establish these space parks, which are basically orbitary zones which stop satellites basically deploying internet coverage over certain spaces and applying that digital free zone into cities? Is it not that there should be same way in prisons right now? We basically put surfaces in prisons that stop internet connectivity for prisoners. Should we not have some places that effectively mean that you could go into the library and you can't connect? You could go in there. So if I just speak to that for one more second, because I'm very passionate about it, and I don't think most people have thought about what's coming. They take for granted the ability to disconnect, to turn the phone off, push the computer away. But when you and the computer are merged, you can't do that. So I want to talk about, there's definitely risks to the proposition of what I'm talking about, but I want to first of all talk to the benefits of doing that. And obviously mental health and well-being benefits, I don't think that they're too hard to put your head around of mindfulness. We've done pretty good researches as a planet on how people do really well when they disconnect from their devices. And also we are very aware of the benefits of forest bathing, if you will, actually what happens to our neurochemistry when we get out in the wild and connect with the wild. But this wildlife protection point of a digital free national park, we can't underestimate. You know, there are question marks about 5G. We love 5G. It's great for us. Some of your weather scientists wouldn't agree. They'll say it's interfering with their weather predictions. And the truth is, if digital free national parks don't exist in the future, we won't even have controlled studies. We won't have a place on Earth where we can even make a decision of how we're being impacted by continual connection. The other big point, like just pushing into this AI mitigation point and coming back to the sort of the Hinton point, the Elon Musk point, is what security do we have? If I am able to exert warfare, if you get an AI out of the box type scenario, if there's nowhere to disconnect, you know, Elon Musk's response is stick a Neuralink in your head. Elon Musk's response is we might have to bomb the servers in locations. So I don't think if he's saying that and he's an expert, I don't think it's that far out for us to say, well, maybe we should just leave some places disconnected. Okay. And then, of course, maybe there's environmental economic impact, because the truth is the national park concept, it's been around for a couple of hundred years. There's more than 4,000 of them around the world, and actually they've been stellar. People pay to go to national parks. They have a net benefit, a profit benefit to an economy to have national parks. So I don't think that we could say that it would just be just an expense to create those. But then probably the next thing most people would say, well, what's the risks? Is that even safe? And I think that here is something really that's a really a smart city concept, which is that making a city smart reduces crime for the reasons we've already talked about, because the more you surveil people, the less they can do things that you can't see what they're doing, and then you can punish them accordingly. So a lot of people have said, well, there's a security problem with a digital free national park, because you are effectively creating a place where crimes can happen without being observed. And then I think that the natural response to this is, what do we have now? Are national parks a hotbed of crime? And I'll put it to you that they're not, because most places where crimes are committed are in cities and high population centres. So there's probably something that needs to be, there is nuance that needs to be looked at on that security point or crime point. But I don't know if people, if you really understand the psychology behind criminal events, most people are not prepared without a heat of passion to drive 6 hours to a national park to go and drag someone to commit a crime. I don't want to underplay that. It's real. It's a real problem. The other thing that's a potential risk is obviously in terms of security of, say, for example, if there's a fire. So there are analog solutions, and there are definitely things that can be done which allow people to still contact someone, analog phone system every 2Ks, you know, people signing waivers when they enter these areas. But I think that's the main thesis is there risks of creating places that are disconnected? Yes, there are. Are those risks on the heat map of, or our risk matrix of a community, of a nation, of a world, are those the same risks as, I would put it to you, the highest risks on the risk matrix, which some people are now saying at 5% or 4.7%, that we're approaching a future state where AI actually should be considered to be an existential threat.
Thanks so much for sharing. That's super interesting. And yeah, I think it's something that I think about as well. And even as you were talking, just thinking about when I take the opportunity to disconnect, like, I guess being connected allows me to have the opportunity to disconnect, because I can work from anywhere, et cetera, but then I can go, okay, I'm out for this week, or whatever the case is. And so I think that's a really interesting concept, that it's also not, they're not, I think smart communities and having digital free areas are not mutually exclusive, because I think you have to want that, because you want the human connection digitally, but then also to be able to disconnect, because we know what the benefits are to be able to do that. So yeah, I like that a lot. And I think, yeah, like you said, there's risk with everything, but if we're moving towards a future where we literally cannot, and thinking about, like, just not from, you know, our perspective, but other people that, you know, there may be very good reasons why they'd want to disconnect from a whatever situation they're in, not wanting to be surveilled all the time, not because they're doing anything wrong, but because there's certain issues, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's all these different concepts as well. And I think if we only think of more surveillance increases safety or better or efficiency, then we end up in a place where we don't really want to be.
There's lots of ways to be unsafe.
Yeah.
Lots of ways, and they point in different directions. And human rights point in different directions. And usually it's a balancing act of who do you protect when. That freedom of speech is a counterfactual to harmful content being moderated. So there's often a give and take when we make these decisions. But I think the establishment of digital free zones, digital free national parks, is a prudent and measured response to the perpetual and inevitable connectivity ahead of us. And I think that governments, each government in each nation state, will need to engage with what legislative measures they need to put in place in order to be able to afford those zones space and creation.
So moving to the future now, I mean, we've just kind of been talking about it, but what are the other, well, either I think this is a future trend that people aren't talking about enough, right? But what are the future trends that people aren't talking about enough?
I'm interested, I suppose, in a world where, again, curated spaces and times. So if, for example, we move to an implantable future where most people have some kind of perpetual connectivity, is it that we legislate for times when you can't advertise, or vulnerable populations that you can't advertise to? We have the existing legislation, for example, that moderates what TV shows could be played to children. You know, people don't watch TV anymore. You know, some of those old laws, which were really well thought out and had good intentions, some might say they're a bit nanny state, we haven't really pushed those things into gaming. We haven't pushed those things into necessarily into our social medias. I think a really good example is the way that China moderates its social media, particularly for children, is quite different how social media is moderated for children in America or in Australia. So whether we need to say, actually, there are digital quiet zones, there are quiet times that we recognise that, you know, I in my past have lived in a country where there was basically a breakdown in the rule of law. And there were certainly very wealthy people who still lived there, but most people were very poor and, you know, living a very difficult life without access to basic resources. And even wealthy people in states, nation states, where there is an absence of the rule of law, they don't do very well. It's no fun living in a country where most people are not doing very well, even if you're super rich. So I do think there will need to be increasing consideration of advertisements that impede our virtual space. And things change really quickly, especially with convergence of tech. So a lot of things I'm talking about now, we've been talking about for a few years, but people thought it was science fiction. And actually, the science fiction is now. And law tends to move quite slowly. It's a good thing that the law moves slowly because you want to have certainty around the law. But legislative change can take time. And we've seen it done pretty quickly with COVID. But for some of these concepts, I think that there needs to be working groups in governments who are able to think about what times, what spaces we restrict our connectivity generally.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I think, another thing in the future, because we know that there's, things we don't even think about, what we just take for granted, depending on where we live. And you kind of recognize those when you go to a place where the laws are different, or, you know, different restrictions are there or not, or lax or not. Yeah, it is really interesting. And I think a very prudent kind of future trend, well, not a trend necessarily, but something we need to consider and do things about now, like you said, because, science fiction is now, and they'll just be continued, like we'll just continue in that space. So where to next for smart communities?
Something that we've been playing around with at Sterling and Rose is thinking about institutional data trusts and thinking about, and I'm not saying that this would not bear well for me to be out there saying give more tax, people should pay more tax, but I want people to think a little bit differently about tax and think about data a little bit differently. And think that data actually is the mother's milk of AI. So you can't get to AI without data. And if you think about all these things in a smart city as surveillance mechanisms, and don't just think of the word surveillance as spooky, think about surveillance in a way, it's just watching what we do, which then helps us to create better ways of doing things in the future. Or hopefully not pushing you to do worse things. But anyway, it can just create looking at what people do. Then the people who hold the data and the mass amounts of data are king. They have the key to the castle. So when we talk about data taxes and we talk about a data trust, it's almost, again, a future state library that nation states should think about having, where if you are an organization that collects enormous amounts of data, that maybe you should be compelled, or if you're a government or if you're a university, you should be compelled to at least share some portion of potentially that de-identified data with a public repository that is accessible to all, so that that evens the playing field of basically not creating data megaliths that have some unfair advantage over the rest of us who are not able to basically compete or respond. It just pushes a too great a difference between the data rich and the data pool. So that's something else we've been playing around with. It's not a fully constructed concept, but it's just a thought experiment.
Yeah, I like that. And I think it's a really interesting one and something I've been, in the work that I do as well, talking around governance and, you know, think about these four precincts coming together, different things coming together. What does that data trust or what does that actually look like? Because we want, and even levels of connectivity under the ground, you know, fiber, those type of things. How do you have a public interest entity that can actually manage that ongoing? Because we know that just purely based on profits, then you don't get that equity that we're trying to achieve across the community.
So this is where we come full circle. So this is really, really interesting. So again, some of the things we do at Stirling and Rose is we deal with decentralized autonomous organizations and autonomous organizations. And that's when you effectively give over control of governance to an algorithm or a decentralized platform like a blockchain. So again, super interesting. If you talk about autonomous organizations, they're not necessarily moderated by the infrastructure of blockchain, but they are saying that in the future, we know that in decision-making, in governance, that we will push over governance decision-making to a machine if it does a better job than us at governing. So human frailty means we get things wrong. In legal processes, we move from a position in order for a legal case, a piece of litigation. It used to be a whole bunch of humans sitting around a table, reading lots of documents to find out what the smoking gun was. But it became part of our legal duties to use what's called technology-assisted review because technology did a better job than humans of actually looking at the corpus of data and establishing what the truth of the situation was. So with autonomous organizations and governance, we believe that we are moving to a position where it may be that a director who is basically an algorithm, and I use the word who in an interesting way here, because the law may need to shift the same way as the word legal person actually includes corporations. So they're not humans, but corporations are caught by that definition in corporations law. We may need to move to a position where actually algorithms or machines are caught as also basically part of the governance matrix and therefore part of liability. The reason that it gets super, super interesting is because the way that we punish people for breaking the law generally at its worst involves putting people in prison. And this is what we call the responsible machine problem, is that machines don't care if you put them in prison. So the long arm of the law is ultimately one of violence, and the violence cannot be perpetrated against a machine in a way that a machine cares. So there is a really big governance question here about when we use machines in decision making or algorithms and they do a better job than us, what stops them making bad decisions where they have perhaps made decisions that we would disagree with from some moral standpoint or some other human-induced standpoint. But again, these things are not science fiction. They used to be. And in some states in the world, they actually have what is called DAO legislation, legislation that deals with decentralized autonomous organizations. So again, that's the sort of thing that we advise clients on. It's not science fiction. It's happening right now.
Super interesting, Tasha. Thank you so much. I feel like, yes, we could definitely have a lot more conversations, and I do look forward to having more conversations with you in the future. I've really, really enjoyed this. So thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today.
Not at all. Thanks, Zoe.
Just one last question. How can people connect with you?
Well, primary way to connect with me is LinkedIn. I love collecting a good digital community on LinkedIn. And the other thing is, it's not me, but it's a group of people that I'm involved with. Go to www.digitalfreenationalparks.com, check it out and sign the petitions, because this is effectively about pushing governments around the world to create these digital free spaces in the future.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We'll put all the links in the show notes so people can click away and find you. Yeah, really appreciate you coming onto the podcast, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Zoe.
Talk soon. Bye.
Are you looking for an engaging speaker, MC, or facilitator for your next big event? Then we've got you covered. Zoe is a go-to speaker, MC, and conversation facilitator with a difference. She's a master at simplifying the complex and making connections you might never see. Book Zoe for your next event. Email hello@mysmart.community or head over to her speaker page, www.mysmart.community/speaking.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.